You're all very welcome to the doctoral defense by Nelson Medina on perspectives on the unity of the human person in Bernard Lonergan. My name is Declan Marmion, and I'm the head of the Hispanic department here at Theology in the Institute. And my role this afternoon is simply to chair the proceedings. And what happens is as follows. Nelson will initially present a summary of his work in 15 minutes or so, 15-20 minutes. And then each of the examiners then will engage you with your work and clarify things with you. We have the internal reader is Raymond Maloney, whom we all know here from the Institute. And then we have as the extern Dr. Philip Egan, so very welcome, Philip, from Science of Shrewsbury, who's come over to be with us for this defense. And then that will then bring the visa then to a close. Okay, so without further ado, then, Nelson, I'll hand over to you. I'll act as timekeeper, so if you see me look at my watch, it means you have to come into land, okay? So it's over to you.
Thank you, everyone, for coming. I see this thesis as an exploration between a great problem and a great thinker. The intersection between a great problem and a great thinker, the problem can be traced back, at least, back to Plato and Aristotle. And the great thinker, of course, we are thinking today is Bernard Lonergan. The texts considered in the thesis are, according to the chapters, what you see on the screen. The Annotaciones, the Verbo Incarnato, was a course that Bernard Lonergan took in the academic year from 1935 to 1936. Then we have this article, Finality of Love and Marriage, in 1943. Then two chapters of my thesis are devoted to corresponding chapters in Insight that was published in 1957, and then in Method in Theology there's a chapter on religion that has a close relationship with the theme of the thesis. Okay, the human being can be considered as a knower, and in this case we speak of modes of presence of the self to itself, the subject as subject, and themes about self-appropriation. This is a way of approaching the theme. The other way is the human being as knowable, as known. In this case, we get a series of perspectives. And this was my approach, actually. So themes about self-appropriation, subject as subject, which are, of course, very interesting, are not directly dealt with in this particular work. What kinds of perspectives we get? Well, for each chapter, we can assign a sort of label, general label. There is an evolutionary perspective in chapter 2. There is a hierarchical perspective in chapter 3. There is a developmental perspective in chapter 4. And there is a dialectical perspective dealt with in chapter 5. Well, what about chapter 1? Chapter 1, I think, is... of course, it is an introduction to the classical background, but it is also the occasion of introducing explanatory knowledge, which is very important for what is about to come in the other chapters. The old theme of episteme as opposed to doxa, knowledge as opposed to opinion, we could say, and mainly the what turned into the why as it appears in chapter 17 of Book Z in the Metaphysics of Aristotle. That was a kind of turning point in Lonergan's intellectual journey. And I think that it brings us to Lonergan's intellectual conversion. Let me say a little bit about this kind of conversion. Aristotle turned the what into the why in taking a question like, what is a man, turned into why these parts make a whole. And that is a change, because to some extent the what question is intractable or only leaves us with that sort of comparison. This is similar to this. But the why, it is the introduction of understanding as the main tool, if you like, in real knowledge, in episteme. Now, every explanation entails a connection between terms, and then the question is, what is this kind of explanation? Where does the nexus come from? Is it seen, deduced, created? That was part of Lonergan's intellectual conversion, because the Thomists' dominant position at the time, and this includes Cajetan, John of St. Thomas, Suarez, was that knowledge was a comparison of impressed species within the intellect. And you can see that this is at the origin of the Kantian distinction between analytic and synthetic propositions. In this case, understanding occurs in the faculty, in the so-called faculty of judgment. And then what you see is that there is no connection between the category of substance and the existing substances. So existence is not really grasped. It can only be posited by the mind, but it is not grasped. The change that Lonergan did, and what he proposed as well, was related to this fact that existence is not posited by the mind. Aquinas' position, according to Lonergan, was that the nexus itself is grasped. And Lonergan has this interesting phrase, you understand something. The existence of that which exists is crucial to the act of understanding. So it is not the human mind playing games. It is really connecting with the reality. And that was the conversion, if you like, from nominalism to critical realism. Then we have about what was the occasion of getting this. Well, it was a course given by Bernard Leeming, as I said. And of course, the problem is that we cannot understand Christ just by looking at Christ. It is not an intuition of Christ that will solve the problem of how he can be a human being and not a human person, according to the traditional and standard Catholic teaching. So it is necessary to get the difference between essence and existence, and this is a kind of difference that cannot be grasped just looking at Christ. Then you have this autobiographical annotation about one of his classmates, Stefano, who led him, to some extent, to this kind of distinction. Okay, this has implications about the concept of science, that what has been turned into the why. The why is the nexus and leads us to grasping existence. And so knowledge is knowledge of the real. This is the main thing. Knowledge is knowledge of the real. Science is understanding, a concept that we'll find later on. And then the last consequence of this, at least in the scope of this work, is that a species is the answer to the problem of living in an environment, a notion that would be very important in the classification of different beings. So the intuitionist version is that knowledge is mental abstraction of universal concepts from things. And Lonergan portrayed this version as a halfway house between materialism and idealism. On the other hand, what results from this is that the real is the observable. But what he proposes, his version, is that knowledge is a discursive process, the one we are familiar to, if we know about Lonergan, from experience to understanding to judging. This is a beautiful quotation from Mac Padlan about the project of questioning and the reality of objectivity. What would be objectivity from a non-Erganian perspective? The real, of course, would be the verified. We have to keep moving, sorry about that. This is chapter 2, Finality, Love, Marriage. The question The overall question in this article is searching for an all-embracing perspective in which love and the human could be properly situated. But this is connected to a lot, this goes far beyond the reality of marriage, the reality of couples. To go to the point, Lonergan's answer is that the most essential end of marriage is procreation, but its most excellent end lies on the supernatural level of personalist development. So there is a difference between kinds of or types of ends, and this led him to the differences between kinds of finality. So there is a theoretical part about finality. You have absolute finality, which is the relatedness of everything to God. You have horizontal finality, which is the result of abstract essence, which is to speak of the what we can expect from something because of its nature, because of what it is. But then the notion, the contribution that Lonergan is bringing to the scene is a vertical finality. I find very inspiring, very suggesting this concept of vertical finality. There are several differences between vertical and horizontal finality. Horizontal is abstract because it is connected to the essence. Vertical finality is about the concrete. It is not from the isolated instance, but from the conjoined plurality. By the same token, it is connected to statistical laws. Classical laws took the whole scene in classical thought. But Lonergan is taken seriously into account statistical laws and the probabilistic outcome of a plurality, of a conjoined plurality. And vertical finality is also universal in the sense that it gives us a vision of the cosmos as such. It is a huge vision, and it deserves more attention. Well, science, sex, and fecundity, what was the point? Lonergan says that it was the entering, the introduction of biological science that changed the scene in speculation or in the theological treatment of marriage. And the reason is that the difference between sex and fecundity was very, very clear. It became very, very clear when biological science entered into the scene. Sex would be connected with the personal end, and fecundity, of course, would be with the procreative end. There is a sort of opposition. We can see that even now in current theological discussions. So the question is how concurring but different ends relate to each other. The complex answer of Lonergan goes far beyond the reality of couples as such, and as I said before, it renders a cosmic vision of that we can call as well an evolutionary perspective. Now, there is a relationship between science and vertical finality because science is about laws, and laws are not only classical systematic laws, but there are the non-systematic, the statistical laws. And the statistical probabilistic side of modern science connects with the per accidents component of vertical finality. So that is why vertical finality at the same time is related to everything that exists, but can only be properly expounded if we take into account modern science. Now, the unifying factor is the ascent of love, but this is not a ready-made answer. If we ask where that vertical finality of thrust come from, well, we see that if statistical science is taken seriously, it comes from emergent probability. If we take seriously friendship, we can say that it comes from friendship in the case of marriage. So there is a vertical, there is an ascension, unpredictable ascension for each human being in a couple just for the fact of growing into friendship. And then if we take absolute finality seriously, we see that there is also the level of grace. So nature and then history and then grace are connected in this overall vision. If we ask what's the in what consists or what gives unity to the human being from this perspective, definitely it is love. It is an evolutionary perspective. Sex, of course, is not seen as a biological, as a mere biological fact, but it is a reality that embraces everything that is human, because it is not only present at the organic level, but it is present in the growing, in the growth of friendship, and it is present and sanctified by the action of grace and the sacrament. So it is very, it's a very wide vision. We see the connection between emergence probability and vertical finality. We have this quotation from Lonergan's Quest, as other quotations that you will find later on. Well, chapter 3 is about the hierarchical perspective, and of course the point of view here is the levels of human activity. The chapter itself is devoted to things. That's the short title it bears. Then the problem is bringing to light how the results of different sciences add up to an understanding of the complexity and unity of the human being. And the challenge is reductionism, and it is mechanicism. Especially reductionism will be of our interest in this chapter. The itinerary of the chapter goes from Aristotle's substance, Kant's noumenon, Darwin's species, so there's something for everybody, I suppose. And then you have the Lonergan's complex account of the unity and concreteness of things. That's the general process of the chapter. It's a very complex but very rich chapter that, of course, deserves even more attention. A thing can be regarded, this is a crucial distinction, could be regarded as a body, and already out there, now real, to whom we relate to as animals do. For example, water quenching my thirst. When we are thirsty, as I will be in a few minutes, we are not thinking of the nature of water. We are just solving, fixing a problem. But then you have also a thing as a thing. The concept of thing corresponds something to whom we relate to at a proper human level. For example, when we are thinking of water that has to reach every household in the city. In that case, I'm not just fixing an instance of a problem, but I am asking about what is. It's the kind of questioning. And this leads us to the known series experiencing, understanding, and judging. Experience will supply material for questions, and then we have the two levels of questions. Questions for intelligence of the type, what is it? And questions for reflection of the time, is it so? These are the two types of questions. So this is the origin of the series experience, experiencing, judging, and experiencing, understanding, and then judging. So if we see things as a body, that stands for already out there, now real. If we see things as a body, that would be the instinctive animal kind of knowledge, which has its own importance, of course, and we need that as well. If we see unity as grasped in experiential conjugates, what we get is at the level of Aristotle's categories. I find very interesting that Lonergan's description of Aristotle's categories corresponds to what he calls experiential conjugates, which are still at the descriptive level. They are not fully explanatory knowledge. And then we have unity grasped in explanatory conjugates, which are corresponding to fully human knowledge. So what about reductionism? Well, reductionism is an overall plan that pledges to explain everything using the set of laws that already explain the simplest and most basic phenomena in the universe. Ideally, for reductionists, it intends to embrace all phenomena as subsections of a huge text of physics. The presupposed question is that no, that, well, the principal's question and affirmation would be that no new concepts are strictly required when moving from science, from one level of science to the next. Lonergan will be absolutely opposed to this, as we see in a minute. Charles Darwin is also mentioned in this chapter because of his reductionist intention, not to deny the importance of Darwin, but in regard of this elaboration of the relationship between sciences, Darwin has to be counted among the reductionists. So he tried to explain complexity in terms of the basic rules of evolution and sex. Every aspect of human life can and must be explained in terms of the same basic principles leading the evolutionary processes from species to species. And he, in The Descent of Man, he mentioned explicitly these three principles: variation, inheritance, and natural selection. What's Lonergan's response to the reductionism? First of all, distinguishing between higher and lower levels. The key point here is the distinction between images and insight. This is the key distinction. The successive departments of science, if we move from physics to chemistry, from chemistry to biology, biology to sensitive psychology, if we climb up this ladder, what we find is that every science is taking images from the lower science. So there is a process that is going from image to insight. And it will prove to be very important in an overall vision. In Lonergan's upward view of the scientific disciplines, the key notion is that every higher level and its higher conjugates, forms or relations, establishes a completely new dimension of freedom. And that dimension is an analogy to the relationship between imagination and insight. As I said, this leads to a cosmic view, if you like. So, human being, according to this difference between different sciences, the human being is subject to different sets of laws. So there are distinguishable levels in the human being. But understanding is irreducible to its materials. So what has to be studied as chemistry in the human being cannot be reduced to physics. What has to be studied as biology in the human being cannot be reduced to chemistry, and so on and so forth. So we find that the unity of the human being cannot be correctly expressed by accumulation of successful accomplishment of the same basic routines. For example, routines as explained by physics or by chemistry. The human being derives its unity from the successful integration of the operations of each level into higher levels. So this is kind of a second response to the big question of the thesis. If you are asking about the unity of the human person, the first question was that evolutionary perspective from chapter 2, in which we see the role of love. The second response would be these levels, different levels of sciences and different levels of reality. What would be a species from this perspective, from this point of view? Well, it is not an accumulated aggregate of theoretically observable variations. It is an intelligible solution to a problem of living in a given environment. And I think this is a great insight. The facets and dimensions of the problem of living in a particular environment correspond to the facets and dimensions of the solution, which means that there is a true ascent from one level to the other, and the intelligibility of the problem and the laws involved correspond to the complexity of the form of life responding to that complexity. So there's no shortcut in rendering the complexity of the human being. And I think this preserves the dignity and the freedom that is that belongs to human beings. But even further, this leads us to the theorem, what Lonergan calls the theorem of isomorphism. Imagination is to understanding as any lower level of being is to the next level up. The relation between our understanding and our imagination reflects a fundamental ontological structure in the universe as a whole. And then this also leads to a very interesting notion of the spiritual. What would be the spiritual level? If he speaks of level in the levels in the human being, what would be the spiritual level? Well, intelligibility, first of all, intelligibility is intrinsic to being, and you have that dense quotation from Lonergan. But then the notion of the spiritual would be that intelligibility that is not intelligent is material, and intelligibility that is intelligent is spiritual. So the central form, of course, every being has a form, but what the central form in human being, is it material? Is it spiritual? Well, according to Lonergan, it has to be spiritual. And starting from the adjective, he takes this notion, the spiritual is not first a noun to be scrutinized in the laboratory, which is constantly the objection of some scientists. Show me the soul, let me put it under the microscope. It's not the idea, it's not first a noun to be scrutinized. Spiritual is the ever-present adjective that silently accompanies intelligent acts of the intelligibility that we are. So the spiritual becomes the center and ground of unity, and this is kind of our third response of the problem we are dealing with. The spiritual is comprehensive, assures Lonergan. What can embrace the whole universe through knowledge can provide the center and ground of unity of a single man. In chapter 4, we move to a different perspective, of course, this time a developmental perspective. The question this time is, how does human development, organic, psychic, and intellectual, relate over time to the self? The new point here is, of course, time. That's what is new in chapter 4. Please take into account that development is not another name for change, and development is not a further element in explaining how members of the same genus or even across genera are different. For example, it would be pointless to ask, is a poet more developed than a mathematician? That's not the idea. Development, according to Lonergan, entails the idea of some direction, or more precisely, some finality. So there's a connection between this chapter and chapter 2 of the thesis. Of course, we need a different method. We have spoken already of classical method, classical laws, statistical method, which will be connected to probability and statistical laws. Now we have genetic method. In chapter 15, Lonergan introduces genetic method. It's not simply that things change, but the fact that new skills can be acquired by the same subjects, and mainly that new sets of conjugates rule successive and connected stages of the same being. So the reason why classical laws cannot render sufficient explanation of development is that rules themselves are changing. So we need a rule ruling the change of rules. So we need a different kind of method.
There's three more minutes, okay, so try to wind things up a little bit.
Good, thank you. So what remains constant when development happens? Well, according to Lonergan, it is not anything that happens in central potency, central form, or central act. The change has to be related, the developmental change has to be related to the conjugates. And what he says is that in each instance, for example, organic development, psychic development, and intellectual development, we should see what is the process that is going on. And he introduces, I have to skip to that point, of course, to integrators and operators. This is dense, it is complicated, it is not fully elaborated, but that only means that more study would be worthwhile. So he sees two aspects of higher systems, an integrator, which is not superimposed on a particular thing, but it is a term for conjugate forms that systematize the otherwise coincidental manifolds of a developing organism. And then the operator, which is not strictly different in terms of being, it's not different from the integrator, but it is the same set of conjugates, but in as much as they pull up to a higher and more complex stage. I mentioned in the thesis the corresponding 8 stages of Erik Erikson, stages of human development, with some relationship with the integrator operator position of Lonergan. And then in intellectual development, I only would like to highlight what we find here. Intellectual development rests upon the dominance of a detached and disinterested desire to know. So when a person reaches this level, we can say that there is intellectual development. It is not the capacity of doing so, but it is the fact of acting that way. And I think I have to leave it by the time at this point. And we can mention, probably according to the questions that you may have, we can mention something about chapter 5. Again, thank you very much for attending.
Thank you very much for that. I invite Ray and Philip to join me up here. And each of the leaders will have 15 to 20 minutes engaging with you, Nelson. And first will be Ray.
So, Nelson, first of all, I congratulate you on your thesis. And the first thing I'd like to commend about it is the English. For a non-English speaker, it's very impressive and certainly an achievement. Except I came across two very strange words. I meant to look them up for curiosity in the dictionary. One was disambiguated. The other one was dynamicity. Well, we know what they mean, but anyway, I thought it was intriguing. You have some of the standard, occasionally, not very often, but you have some of the standard problems that non-English speakers have with the definite article, which people with Latin language backgrounds introduce more frequently than in English. And so those kind of things are things that would have to be polished up in any ultimate publication of this kind of thesis. Now, I'd like to ask you a question. What brought you to this topic in the first place?
Thank you for asking. When I came to Ireland about 6 years ago, my first intention was to work something on Aquinas, sort of family thing, if you like. Mm-hmm. And my interest at that point was the unity of the human soul, because I learned that in the 13th century, the dominant position in the University of Paris was not that there is a unique substantial form in the human being, but it was the Platonic version that was dominant at that time. So that there is a vegetative soul, there is a sensitive soul, and there is a rational, properly rational soul, or substantial forms. And they would, scholars at that time, would affirm that these three souls existed at that time. Aquinas was contrary to that position. He made his case. And eventually, the Catholic Church, and I would say most of the Western world, welcomed Aquinas' position. So I was interested in that kind of problem. But then, in entering into conversation here with my lecturers and possible direction of thesis and all that, it seemed that it would be good to relate that kind of investigation to more recent thinkers. And that was the natural choice, in some sense, would be Bernard Lonergan, because of his own background and also the background of this particular place, and also because he was an English writer, English language writer, I mean. So it would be natural to study Lonergan. But then entering into Lonergan's studies, well, it is not a world, it is a universe. So this is only part of what can be said on this topic in Lonergan. So to try to attempt to make a comparison with another author beyond or beside himself would be too much. So that's a short story.
Sure, okay. Well, what do you see, having surveyed all this, what do you see as your contribution to that?
I think that the series of responses that we find in each chapter have their own interest. It is not that often that we find this kind of serious reflection about love, as it appears, for example, in chapter 2. Love as an all-embracing reality, not only for couples or not only for people, but even for the universe. It could sound familiar to some people nowadays because of this renewal of in spirituality, but to present this kind of reflection, I think, deserves attention. And then again, there is a series of themes that have also been highlighted. So in presenting these answers from Lonergan, I think there is a service to the academic community. The levels of activity, this theorem of isomorphism that I mentioned 5 minutes ago, I think it is very interesting. And these are points that deserve attention and study. So to some extent, what I am doing is just presenting, in hopefully in a clear and useful ways, results that come from Lonergan's extensive work.
Is there any particular aspect of this topic, as you presented there, that enthuses you?
Oh, many, many of them.
Well, give us an example.
Many of them. And I even wrote some of them here, not to forget any. And they are at least 9 of them.
Oh, nice.
At least 9 of them. I was sort of expecting all these themes that are mentioned here. I think would make for a good paper, for a good article, if they were properly written. And then this is another series that is also interesting. For example, this one, Solidarity and Sin, Solidarity and Grace. Lonergan was kind of a precursor of many themes that later on would be developed, for example, in Second Vatican Council and other instances of the Church's life. This solidarity and sin sounds very familiar for somebody like me coming from South America, because it is connected to liberation theology. Structures of sin is connected to this one. And also, this is now familiar to Lonergan students, falling in love as a description of religion. The grace forms of knowing is also very interesting. It comes from Catherine McCann, who recently wrote a book about spirituality in everyday life. Yeah, and the last one is also very interesting to me. The rehabilitation, if you like, of common sense. I like it. I did like it very much.
Now, Lonergan is a controversial figure in contemporary Catholic thought. How do you see him in that context? Do you have anything to say?
If you don't mind, if you'd like to narrow a little bit the question.
Well, you see, some people are all for him and some are all against him. And you kind of wonder, you know. What is it about him in particular that catches you,
Well, I had the opportunity of having a couple of long talks with Morelli. Now I'm forgetting the name.
Mark Morelli.
Mark Morelli, thank you. Mark Morelli. I had a couple of long talks with him. And one of the topics was this one, because obviously Lonergan is one of the most brilliant thinkers of the 20th century, I have no doubt about that. And he said this expression that I could partially make mine. He said, Lonergan didn't learn to play the academic game. And by that he meant that some of his expressions, for example, experiential conjugates, didn't stick. And that's part of the reason. When the vocabulary, when the terms used by a thinker don't go mainstream, there is always a veil of esotericism that is like wrapping the whole world, the whole corpus. But it is my conviction that using the same words or using parallel or similar terms, the concepts that were expressed by terms like these are very important and very relevant. So I think that's one point probably. And there is a task to do in that. The other point is that I think that in some moral issues, Lonergan came to a certain point and then stopped. So probably people, authorities in the church were wondering, where did he really stand? And one point in case would be, for example, marriage. We know, we all know, this is a controversial issue even nowadays. So I suppose some people would embrace wholeheartedly Lonergan if they were sure that Lonergan said exactly what the Magisterium has said later. But as he stopped in some topics, some controversial topics, he stopped. So there is, again, some sort of doubt in certain circles. I think that a proper expounding of his thought would be useful both for the Lonergan club and for people that don't know, really, the richness that is in his works.
Well, the next question you've almost answered already, but when you turned to him, you had a certain expectation. And I'm wondering, do you consider that he fulfilled it?
More than that, yes.
Yeah, that's the impression I was getting.
Yes. Well, I have had the opportunity of studying some of Lonergan in my own country. And then I came to Milton and have a couple of courses with yourself. So that was, of course, inspiring. That was interesting. But still, there are some treasures that were waiting. Things like this vision of the parallel or the isomorphism between the process of knowledge and the levels of reality. It really is the mark of a great thinker. And I wasn't expecting that, I have to confess. So that was a kind of positive surprise for myself. That doesn't mean that everything was wonderful and everything was plain sailing. It wasn't, of course. We all know about the labors that are involved in this kind of work. But I can't say that I have met a thinker that have exceeded my expectations.
Okay. Well, now, I was surprised when I read the introduction to your thesis and find that it's a thesis in theology. Now, supposing that somebody were to put to you, this isn't theology, it's philosophy. What would you say?
Well, I also had an answer for that. Because I asked myself several times about that, and there are several theological themes that appear. You are almost to see them, because there is a list that I make, at the very beginning. The idea is that every time we speak of the unity of the human being, there is more than philosophy that is at stake. And the reason is that when we're speaking of human beings, we're speaking of redemption. We're speaking of eternal life. It is interesting that back in the 13th century, the fuel for all the controversy was about eternal life. So what happens with the vegetative soul when people die? What happens to sensitive soul when people die? So it is all about eternal life. That's one side of the problem. Then a core concept in the thesis is, of course, finality and absolute finality and vertical finality. And we realize that there is no way of assuring that there is vertical finality in the universe unless we recognize absolute finality, which is the relatedness of everything to God. So that's one of the reasons, I suppose, why secular thinkers, so to speak, with much difficulty would embrace Lonergan, because some core concepts really depend on revelation. They are very, very reasonable. I'm not saying that they are just dropping from heaven or from sky. Of course, they are very reasonable, but they are based on theological concepts. I would dare to make a comparison with another concept from another distinct Jesuit, Teilhard de Chardin. Teilhard de Chardin was assuring the march of everything towards Christ. But for a secular scientist, without revelation, you cannot assure that. So it is reasonable, it is well expounded, it is well presented, it is well structured, but you need revelation for that. So in vertical finality, you need that, of course.
Well, even some philosophers believe in God, after all, and it's part of their philosophy. So just to point to the absolute finality towards God isn't sufficient, it seems to me, in itself. See, obviously what we're doing is relevant to certain theological themes. Like you did mention once or twice about Christ and so on. But what you actually treat of in the thesis, for instance, revelation might be in the background. Revelation might be the ultimate reason why you take up the topic at all. But does revelation really enter into the thesis as such and treat it as such? I mean, is there an actual theological treatment of the issues in your thesis?
What I mentioned at the beginning is that this would be a work on fundamental theology. And we understand from Lonergan himself that there are different specialties. In the case of fundamental theology, it is crucial, of course, the relationship with what doesn't belong to the world of revelation and all that. But we see that key concepts, it is not only finality. It is the spiritual, for example, that is elaborated and is presented according to Christian revelation. And we see that also when speaking of solidarity in sin that is mentioned and solidarity in grace. These are themes that cannot be developed, cannot be even presented without a proper allegiance to Christian faith. And then the final proposal about grace, forms of knowing, it's also... So the role of grace, it is absolutely central, I think. And when describing the ascent, for example, in the case of marriage, when describing the ascent, the end of all the process is beatific vision. And these are exactly his words. So it is present. I think that it is completely present, and it cannot be taken away without everything falling apart. But this is obviously a work on fundamental theology.
Okay. Well, now, just a question about another section of you have an exposition of Darwin. All right, very interesting. I read it, and it's... But I wondered, it's left at the end, I didn't know where it was leading. What is that section doing there? Where is it leading within the thesis?
Well, the chapter 3 of my thesis studies chapter 8 about things in Lonergan. And the whole point of that chapter is about levels of reality, higher and lower sciences. And the enemy, so to speak, is reductionism. Because reductionism, in Lonergan's words, we'll see all things of the same kind. And once we admit reductionism, there is no point in affirming higher and lower levels, and there is no possibility of building up the chapter on things. And again, if we admit reductionism, and Charles Darwin is obviously one great and prominent representative of reductionism, once we admit reductionism, there is a particular image of the human being, which is, in a nutshell, it is that the human being is an instance of the laws of physics. And that's everything that has to be said about the human being. So if we admit Darwin, we have to admit reductionism, and the whole chapter wouldn't make any sense. So to avoid Darwin would be to avoid the central challenge.
Well, I began to see more clearly, actually, from your exposition when you gave it about where Darwin entered into this. But I think sometimes in your you have an idea in your mind and a connection in your mind, but you don't actually articulate it in what you wrote. And I think, for instance, what you've just exposed there could have come in somewhere. I found it missing in the actual exposition. So it hangs together, it makes sense and so on when you explain it. Now, one other thing, I was a bit surprised that you talk about the unity of the human being. And after all, the classical statement of that we have from Aquinas, and it repeated in Nogadin, about the unity of the human composite, body and soul coming together as one being, so on. That, of course, you take that for granted. You don't actually state it in any place. Now, you refer to it. There's one passing reference to that. But you don't actually put it down in a thesis on the unity of the human being. That rather surprised me. And, you see, how people understand the unity of the human being is so important. And for instance, one could have compared it with other theologians. For instance, I think Ranner is rather different on that. And the contrast that flows in between, say, Ranner and Lonergan on a point like that affects theology, given the importance of these people in theology. So again, you were skating near a theological issue, an important theological issue there, but you didn't actually get into it. So again, it's kind of illustrating what I'm saying about, well, this is theology. It's a piece of theology, but somehow some of those things don't come in the way I would have expected them to. I don't have any time to mention.
Can I say something?
Yes, sir, by all means.
Yeah. Well, to two things. I think that when studying different texts, as I did, there is not a unique answer. Almost, you dare to say that every chapter has its own answer to the problem. For example, we see the unifying factor of love in chapter 2. We see this notion of the spiritual and the role of central form in chapter 3. And we see in the case of development, we see integrators and operators, which is another kind of response to that. And we see the role of religion and the dialectical nature of religion development in chapter 5, which is connected to the deepest questions and the deepest reality in human beings. So there is not, I would like to highlight that it is not a unique response to the question, and that's part of the richness of an author like Bernard Lonergan. The second point is that what you were mentioning about Aquinas and the classical response, it is all present in Lonergan, and I think it is all present in the main work, under the title, of course, Central Form. And all the arguing about why central form has to be spiritual and the elaboration of the spirituality of the central form, i.e. the soul, is classical, if you like. We can trace that argument back to Aristotle, for example, when he says that in Latin, anima is quodammodo omnia. So it's the same argument, essentially. And Lonergan is taking this classical argument and is presenting it, and I am mentioning it in the subsection on central form. So in that sense, I think that the answer is presented, that I would say.
Well, It certainly presupposes, I have no doubt about that. Now, a particular question, I'm curious to know how you might explain a particular reference here about conscience. Page 106. Altogether understand this too clearly what you are at. At the bottom of page 106, yes, you see, and particularly the last sentence in that page. In this sense, it is enormously relevant to the study of finality as such, insofar as it serves as a concrete and visible connection between birth. And I wasn't too sure what it was. So maybe you could say a word about conscience and how you understand that whole issue of conscience that comes in there.
That it is referring to finality. So the sentence repeating the subject would be, in this sense, it is enormously relevant to the study of finality as such, insofar as finality serves as a concrete and visible connection between vertical and absolute finality.
Yeah. And what was the first stage? In this sense, it is enormously relevant. I mean, I don't care what it is.
Let me see. I think it is at the second look, obediential manifestation of vertical finality.
Yes. Okay.
Obediential manifestation.
Yes, obediential manifestation. Now, could you say a word about that? Explain how conscience is a manifestation of this obediential type of finality. Explain that a little bit.
Well, it is one of the manifestations of vertical finality. Lonergan speaks of four different manifestations. One of these is obediential manifestation. And I would say it is the part of absolute finality that we can find in vertical finality, in the sense that what is pulling up, so to speak, from one level to the next is not just the act of the creature, but as Lonergan says, there is the divine artisan. He uses that expression. So even above and beyond the acts of the creature, there is the plan. It is, we could say the design, but that's a controversial term. There is the design, there is the plan of the divine artisan.
Yes.
So we are not just fulfilling our will in what we do, but we are also fulfilling God's will. So that's the obediential aspect. I think, I'm not completely sure, but I would say this is also in full accordance with the way, for example, Aquinas sees providence and the governing of God over the world.
Yeah. I was surprised when you said that manifestations of the obediential finality are, well, equivalent, you say, rare. No? Somewhere.
He uses
not
that.
Not many examples of it.
Not many examples, yes.
Yeah.
Well, I think it is not easy. It is not easy to detect when, for example, my will is at the same time God's will. We can be sure that it is happening, and in the long run, we all see our own lives and we see, well, it was God's will what I did at that point. But it's not that clear. So that adjective comes from Lonergan, that rare, that claim that examples are rare, comes from Lonergan himself. And I suppose, this is my hypothesis, that he's referring to the fact that trying to differentiate one's will and God's will is not that easy. At some point we can detect that, but it's not that easy. And when we think, for example, of other creatures, not only human beings, it could be even more difficult. Mm-hmm. In the movement of galaxies, in the expansion of the universe, to detect God's will and laws of physics at work is not that obvious, at least.
Mm-hmm.
That would be my take on that.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Trin. Now I hand you over to the external examiner, Dr. Kirby.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you, Nelson, for the thesis, which I enjoyed very much exploring with you this topic. And I think, a dissertation on the unity of the human being, and particularly what Lonergan can bring to that, is really, a wonderful thing to do. I liked the focus very much. You know, you have a very particular focus in the dissertation. I thought it was a good introduction, that you're principally going to study these five texts. I wondered maybe if you could just say why you chose these particular texts.
Well, the first and most obvious work to go after was Insight, of course. But then in Insight, you have to look for those bits that are more closely related. And levels of activity was obviously something that had to be considered, because it goes back to the posing of the original problem. And levels of activity is mainly present in chapter 8. But then, if staying just with chapter 8, the whole thing of time and development, what after I labeled under the title development, would be left aside. So I think that something about development was also necessary. There are some quotations as well from chapter 16, but I think that mainly these chapters, I'm afraid other texts from Insight also would deserve attention. For example, by the end of his work, when he's speaking of the different kinds of conversion and all that, would be very, very useful. But clearly, one cannot do everything. So you have to pick some of them. Then about finality, love, and marriage, my attention was brought to that point by my first supervisor, William Matthews, here present. And then the chapter on religion was also the fruit of discussion with himself.
Yes. It was certainly, I was thinking of, some of the essays of Lonergan, particularly in Second Collection, and some of the other recent, collected works, 17, which has those later essays of Lonergan, are very much, relevant to so much of, the things that you've been talking about. I was slightly disappointed that you didn't move out maybe into some of those kind of areas. I also just wondered if you might just tell me again exactly how you've sort of divided, how you've chosen to look at aspects of the unity of the human person from the point of view of the human being as known, rather than what I would have naturally gone for, the levels of consciousness, the conversions, all the sort of thing, the core really of Lonergan's sort of contribution, because I actually felt that I just wondered how that was set up. Could you just explain to me again how you're dividing the material and why you've chosen these, this particular route?
Yes, there are two reasons, I suppose. The first one probably would be chronological. We see that the first text that brought intellectual conversion and all this classical background afloat, so to speak, was from 1935, and then Finality, Love, Marriage is from 1943. So, chronologically, the unity of the human being as known goes first. So that the elaboration about self-appropriation, the subject as subject, and the unity of the knower, they went later. So that would be a reason, if we are trying to to explore the problem exactly. If we are trying to explore the problem with some detail from the beginning, probably the choices would be similar to the ones I made. There's no claim of studying every text, of course, but that would be a reason. The second one is that, as you heard a minute ago, my first inclination was coming from Aquinas and this division of souls and all that. So the equivalent in Lonergan is more present in the literature that I studied. So it would be a personal interest in that, in the sense that the line of research that I was trying to do was more compatible with the text that I actually studied.
Right, yes. And, I mean, I think, you know, one accepts that one can never do the last word on a subject and so on. So, I mean, that's kind of quite helpful. I mean, the only sort of thing then would be, so I was kind of looking forward to chapter 5, thinking, you know, we've got that fourth chapter of Method and Theology, its religion and so on. I wonder whether you might just in your own words briefly take me through that chapter 5, just to make sure I've understood it, you know, what you were looking for, because I you do move back to some of the earlier texts of Monaghan.
Yes.
Rather than staying with Method, but could you just take me through that chapter 5? You can do it from the presentation.
It might be a good idea, I think. Yeah. So, yes. Well, we have here chapter 5. Well, there is a whole vocabulary in chapter 5. We have obviously dialectics, and then we have religion, authenticity, intersubjectivity, history, common sense, and love. Love revisited, if you like. Out of these seven, what I like the most in this chapter is what is said about common sense, as I mentioned, because it is brilliant. And it is interesting to see the pace, to see the sequence of them. For example, how do we get from dialectics to religion? It is not obvious. But clearly, dialectics is the core, or one of the ways of posing the core of the problem, because dialectics is about some sort of inner tension. And we have this, that if one admits that there is an utterly transcendental yearning that always dwells in the human heart, one may also share his opinion that the most intriguing features of our dialectic nature lead to inquiries about religion.
I just sort of mention, you see, again, all the topics here are really from that intentionality analysis of Monaghan, and it was just my problem with the setup of the essay I needed you to demonstrate to me kind of convincingly that we can actually look at the human being as a known, in the way you've done. But here we've all of a sudden moved into self-knowing and into those things which are derived from Monaghan's intentionality analysis. I mean, all of those dialectics, is dealt with extensively in chapter 10 in Method. I mean, it's a very beautiful and wonderful sort of thing, but again, it's depending very much on the self-knowing, on subjectivity and so on, and yet we've opted in the essay not to, if I understood you correctly, not to deal with that.
Well, that's one way of seeing dialectics, but we can also speak of the dialectical method in itself, and that goes along classical method, statistical method, and genetic method. So if we see dialectical method as such, as it is introduced, for example, in chapter 6 of Insight, which is the first, to my knowledge, it is the first introduction of the term, that's very much what is needed, what is required for chapter 5, for the usage of dialectics in chapter 5 of my thesis. What I am saying is that the dialectical method that I am presenting here, it is more dependent on chapter 6 of Insight than on posterior or later texts, writings from Lonergan.
So not on method.
No.
In chapter 5.
Exactly.
That's, that's kind of illuminating, really, there. And the whole thing of common sense, particularly when he speaks of the realms of meaning in that chapter, in Method again, I was just slightly disappointed that you didn't connect us more to Method at that point. But anyway, that's kind of the way it is, really, isn't it? There's a couple of things I was just going to ask. You discuss the numbers of levels of consciousness in that fifth chapter. I didn't quite understand. I mean, I know a bit of the background here as well. I didn't quite understand what you were saying in that. Let me just find that in the... can you remember which page? Is it page... It's 5.2.3. Yes, page 296, isn't it? Can you just take me through the sort of argument of that point, what you wish to do?
Well, actually, there is a theological controversy that I suppose stays at the background of this discussion about the levels of consciousness. Probably at the first look, one gets the impression that it is only a description of human beings. But the problem is that if love at some point, using Lonergan's expression, takes over, and at the same time we are admitting that religion is like the upper development in this flourishing of the human being, so you have to pose the question about the relatedness or non-relatedness between grace and levels of consciousness. So in the process of characterizing, in the process of describing and studying every level of consciousness, at some point you have to face where does grace enter into the picture. And that's the background of this kind of discussion. Probably I stop here, and if you would like to elaborate.
We were speaking before about, explore McCann's thought there, grace forms of knowing. I just wonder where you stood on that issue of how many levels of consciousness there are, and, in the Lonergan debate. I mean, are you saying there is a fifth level?
Oh yes, it's an open discussion, and I think I am too little, too small to answer that question, too small in Lonergan's studies to answer that question. My own take at this point would be that fourth levels, with the action of grace permeating, acting in each one of them, is probably more faithful to Lonergan. Probably. Because in some of the interviews, I mentioned some of that in the thesis, in some of the interviews, he seems to stick to that position more. But it is a difficult matter, really, how to describe more properly. The problem you have, if you admit a fifth level of consciousness, what you are saying is that people that haven't reached that level is like alien to the action of God's grace, or alien to the action of God's love in full. And that's too strong a statement, I think. So in that sense, I would prefer to speak of fourth levels of consciousness.
There were a couple of, here and there in the thesis, I really would have valued perhaps a simple word of explanation just to remind me of the meanings of different terms. I mean, it's very technical, and one of my recommendations is that there should be a simple glossary at the back just to explain some of the key Monaghan terms, but there are also I found some dense bits that I couldn't quite grasp. And one of those is actually on in just before the thing on levels of consciousness, and it's page 291. It's just at the top of the. So it's not 291. It's sorry, it's 290. I just wonder if you could dilute it a bit for me. It's the very end of the first section. We're at the end of dialectic, interior and exterior. It's the end of the first section, chapter 5 there. We're back in finality, love, marriage. And so it's really that line beginning, also commenting on a beautiful text. Could you just tell me in your own words what...
I'm not sure I am on the same page. Would you remind me the text?
Yeah, it's you're quoting, you refer to the Secunda Secundae of St. Thomas.
Uh-huh.
Footnote 661.
Yes.
And it's just that page, really.
Mm-hmm.
It was transversal... horizontal and vertical processes. I kind of just became a bit. I should have had another beer at that point. Yes.
Okay. So that.
Could you just say in your own words, as it were, what's going on?
Well, it is interesting. This is referred to, again, to FLM, to finality, love, and marriage. Finality, love, marriage. And it is interesting because I mentioned in my presentation about these three major levels, nature, that is called, in Lonergan's terms, spontaneous organicity. And then we have history, which is at the level of friendship, for example, and we have grace. But then the interaction between horizontal finality and vertical finality creates possibilities that can be called transversal. For example, when we think at this stage it would be good to have an additional picture of the levels, but when we are moving not only at the horizontal level, but we are moving at the same time at the vertical level, we have kind of transversal movement. For example, when we are not only, when it is not only nature moving towards its end, and it is not only nature rendering possible the growth of friendship, but at the same time, you are improving, or you are moving towards nature's end, and you are moving towards historicity, or what is at a historical level, at a human level, in friendship, is working together. So you have kind of transversal movement. And a concrete example of that would be the kind of expressiveness that the couple in their own relationship could have when they learned body language among themselves, between themselves, when they learn, that's not only increasing the possibilities of fecundity, it's not only increasing the possibility of friendship, but it is at once the two ends. That's the kind of transversal movement that is happening. Or again, when they are increasing the possibility of being friends, when they know better each other and they learn to love each other even with all the pitfalls and failures that they have, it is not only growing in friendship, but if they see that as a process that is lived in the frame of the sacrament they have received, that growing in friendship is at the same time an ascent in grace. So that's also a transversal movement. Is that kind of
that's
movement?
Very helpful. It's a concrete example. I mean, one of the things that I think would help the thesis a lot would be to just keep putting in concrete examples to illustrate some of the terms, and then also to make sure that technical terms are explained, because it's pretty, you know, heavy going. I mean, we know that anyway with Flanagan himself. I'm just trying to just ask one more question. It's really relating to this thing of positions, counterpositions. And in, I think it's footnote 718, I've got on my notes here, I'm just going to check that that's correct. Lonergan often writes of the tension between positions and counterpositions. This is page 308 in the text. I just wondered if you might, again, perhaps in your own words, just explain to me what Lonergan would see as a position and what would constitute a counterposition.
Let me see the particular context of this.
Yes, this relates us back to dialectics again. I mean, to me, it's a kind of crucial thing.
I would like to give an example of this. Probably the one we are more familiar with. We know that fully human knowing, in Lonergan's perspective, is that discursive process that goes from experiencing to understanding to judging, and eventually to deciding. That would be the position. The counterposition to that would be that reality is just what is observable, which means that is the already out there, now real. Exactly. So one way of stating things is that the position is right and the counterposition is wrong. And I suppose when one begins studying Lonergan, one gets the impression that he's about to say that every position with this technical meaning of position is right and every counterposition is wrong, simply wrong and simply right. This chapter on dialectics, I suppose, is giving us advice that that's not the case. For example, what is the counterposition about knowledge, which is the out, already out there, now real, is what is proper of common sense. And he's telling us in this chapter and in other places as well, he's telling us that common sense has its own rights, which means that the counterposition has its own rights. So no human being is all the time living at the level of positions and only positions with the technical meaning of these terms, which means that we are to see the relationship between positions and counterpositions not as black and white, not as right and wrong, but in a dialectical manner. And that's part, I suppose, of the fecundity of this chapter 5 of the thesis, but of course mainly of Lonergan's thought on this topic, that we have to realize that this kind of knowledge that is like immediate, like acritical, has its own richness. Because, among other things, it is connected with feelings, it is connected with public opinion, it is connected with fears, and other things that probably wouldn't be that present in the elaborated technical usage of terms that is proper of the position. So in this particular point, this tension between positions and counterpositions is related to that fact that we are not to assure that one of them is completely right and the other is completely wrong, but that we should see the relationship in a dialectical manner.
Yes. I mean, presumably then, we would extend that to that fuller thing that Lonergan speaks of in the chapter, in exactly that part of the chapter in Method. It's a struggle not between any opposites, whatever, but very precisely. juxtaposition between authenticity and unauthenticity, between the self as transcending, the self as transcended. So presumably then we'd be thinking of moral and religious counterposition, so to speak, or inauthentic religion and inauthentic living.
If you ask me, I'm not sure, but I don't think that unauthenticity would be seen as a counterposition in the same sense that animal knowledge is the counterposition to proper knowledge.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you again, Hudson. Thank you, Maloney and Regan, for examining the thesis. We will now, or you will now, confer and consult in room 205, and then your supervisor, will, Dr. Barden here, will get back to you then at the end. Okay, and thank you finally.